chronic alcoholism. How does that even affect your industry? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clory, we're, I guess, responding more directly to the license fee increases in House Bill 3212,
okay,
as opposed to the fortified wine increase, although generally there, again, as an part of the entire alcohol beverage industry, we have taken an overall position that before we look at these dedicated types of revenue sources, that we say take a coordinated approach, and I think there will be somebody from the industry who will speak to that proposal in a minute.
Okay. A quick answer, please, Mr. Chairman, is that I think, too, that our industry sometimes is too silent simply because it doesn't gore our ox immediately. And the fact of the matter is that alcoholism, in particular, is a very large problem to our industry. We suffer a great deal from the alcoholics and the reputations that they have. We, too, want to see the problem solved. We do not think this funding mechanism solves it appropriately and feel we should be speaking out.
Okay, thank you very much. This time we'll ask Mr. Abrams, Mr. Nelson, or Mr. Williamson to come forward, please. But Mr. Williamson signed up first, we'll let him do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charles Williamson from Portland. I represent the Valley Wine Company. I thought it might be, I'm not sure if these statistics do us good or ill, but that it might be interesting for you to know about fortified wine and where it's sold and what it is. The categories that you have there are standard dessert wines, and the LC stands for Livingston Cellars. The TB is for Thunderbird, and the NT is for Nitrine. As you can see, the area that Mr. Clark indicated, we had a lot of people falling down and sleeping on the streets. There have not been any fortified wines sold for over the last year. There's been a ban in the inner city area on fortified wines. We have not opposed that at all and have cooperated with it. And we do not want to see our product have that result. We've also cooperated with the OLCC in raising the price of fortified wine slightly, and at least not posting up, not putting it on sale. I guess the main thing, about 50% is in the low end of the chart here in the Thunderbird and Night Train, but about 50% of fortified wine is your regular sherries and your dessert wines, your vermouth, that would be affected by this bill. The number one account for our company is the Keno's in King City, which does have essentially an elderly population. So you're not, I mean, you say you're taxing the user. I don't think you're really taxing the guy that's passed out on the street. The chances are he's had something else to drink. If you're raising the tax from stopping him to drink it, you're not going to collect any tax if you're successful. I think to some degree the committee should consider that this is probably the most regressive tax you could impose, that it's a tax to tax the poor for their own good, in essence, and it doesn't do either. It's nice that Mr. Clark's wife and Mr. Romaine can afford to pay the tax on this, but it's really it's small potatoes for them. It's a tax by the gallon, not by the price. So I do not think, I echo Mr. Crawford, we think it's a bad source of funding for this or any other state program. I'd be glad to answer questions, Mr.
Thank you very much. I think we'll ask the other witnesses to testify first.
I'm Bill Nelson. I represent the Oregon Wine Producing Industry, Oregon Wine Growers Association, and I also work with the Wine Institute of California, which also represents Mr. Abrams. I think that it's clear that what you are dealing with is a tax increase here, and some of the questions that ought to be asked are, should there be a tax increase, and should the tax increase be on this particular product? I think that the real problem, one of the real problems that we have, is that 90% or more, quite a bit more in some cases, of the consumption of this product is in normal, non-abuse, non-health-threatening situations. This is very different than tobacco, in fact, where almost all consumption of tobacco leads to health problems. Most people properly use alcoholic beverages. And so the linkage between the abuse and the source of the funds is not really all that strong. Another problem that we have, I think has really been highlighted by Representative McCarty, and that is that you're looking at a tax increase. These are, if you choose to raise the taxes on alcoholic beverages, it becomes rightfully state money. That allocation and the fighting for who should get that and what should be done with that really and truly belongs in Ways and Means. So if you think that this tax increase ought to be done, it seems to me that you ought to put it in the general fund and let people go to Ways and Means and figure out what the priorities ought to be, because that is a really difficult problem. Just to highlight one, I think, and particularly in light of Representative Hamlin's discussion of the Court of Appeals decision on Astoria, you may, in fact, by setting up these centers, actually lower the service population of Damish State Hospital, which is the other place where people might get committed, or wherever the appropriate place is. Maybe I'm wrong there. And so I'll just be another minute. That kind of question really and truly belongs in an oversight committee. There are some ordinary table wines which are in the category above 14%. Several wines easily in the ordinary table wine situation will go to 14.5, 14.7, 15, and that will pick up a certain amount of other product that is not fortified. And I think that's all I need to say.
My name is Sidney Abrams. I'm with the Wine Institute, which is the trade association of the California wineries, and I represent the Wine Institute in 12 states. And there's no question these programs we've heard about, people all should be supported, and while our industry is always, and my job is to try to oppose tax increases, I'd rather jeopardize my job than to interfere with the programs. I have only one plea, that if it's, generally a 10% tax increase, it's quite substantial, but a 50% tax, 100% tax increase, if one state does that, then immediately the other states figure, oh, there's an opportunity to increase the funds, and just 100% is a very substantial increase, and I'd hope that the programs could be funded without hitting us. And then one last thing, well, it's true, as Mr. Harris said, that some of these products are obviously aimed for a market that's the targeted market. But originally, and that might be of interest, that I think it was about 1960, if a winery produced only Thunderbird, it would have been the largest winery in the world, the general public, because they're not really wine drinkers as we think of it. It was just an appealing sweet taste and so forth, but obviously they dropped off, and now those things are being consumed by this target population.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your name. The last
Abrams.
Okay. When you introduced something that caused me to come up with a question, and that has to do with kind of equity and comparisons and so forth around the states, and you talked about kind of the domino kind of effect, when one does it, the other. But then the natural question is, how does the tax levied in these ways in this state compared to the surrounding states?
Well, California, your neighboring state, is 2 cents a gallon. That's because wine, grape growing is the largest single legal cash crop in California. It's very obvious what the other untaxed cash crop is. In the state of Washington, it's 83 cents a gallon. Idaho, it's now 50 cents a gallon. Montana, well, those are your immediate neighboring states. But it's all whenever there's the wine tax 10, 15 years ago on all wines was much, much lower. But then for reasons which I won't take the time now, for various political reasons, in Washington state they jumped the tax considerably, because it was up until 1969 only the state liquor board was the only one that could bring in California wines, and the wholesalers could sell only wines produced in Washington. And when it was that the monopoly was taken away from the state. They said we may lose money, so the tax was raised considerably, and then immediately other states started raising the tax because staff people always look to see what neighboring states have, and here's an area to increase tax. And I face this in, well, it goes on in 50 states, but when one state would say, let's increase the tax 100%, I can assure you that, well, that's not your problem.
Okay,
further
questions? Well, thank you.
I'd like to ask Charlie, and you may not be the right one, but I guess I am just a little confused. In your testimony, I believe you brought up about Don Clark's testimony about people in the kind of Old Town area and kind of in the area where his operation is, and then you said, but that wouldn't even apply because of treatment. Oh, was that a banning? I'm trying to remember what happened.
You can see on my thing, in downtown Portland, we have not sold any wine in the downtown area.
And my question is, why is that?
Because the OLCC and the city got together and they said, how are we going to try and deal with this problem? And they said none of the stores down there could
they banned it.
Sell fortified wine.
Okay.
And that's
so
been for over a year.
A ban rather than a tax.
That's right.
Okay. That's okay. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get all this. And I was what I was trying to do was reconcile that with Margaret's testimony about if the counties could only tax it and didn't have to use the state authority, we would do that. And I thought maybe, well, okay. So you have a ban, but not a tax. Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We're going to close the hearing now on House Bill 3212 and 3213. Open hearing on Senate Bill 9788. Bob Geltz and company.
In this case, why not?
Please introduce yourself, Bob, and then I want to ask you a question.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Geltz. I'm a deputy director for the Department of Revenue. On my left is Jim Brown. He's the administrator of the audit division for the Department of Revenue.
Okay, Bob, my question is that I understand that the Ways and Means Committee has not yet funded the department with the people to really put the amnesty program into effect. And so we sat here and listened to this testimony this morning. We were talking about raising revenue for a non-existent program. There appears to be some similarity in that sense only this morning. Is that correct that you've not been funded yet?
That's absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman. At this point, the governor's program has actually two bills, Senate Bill 978, which is the enabling legislation in the amnesty window, and Senate Bill 5537, and that's the appropriation, and that's currently in the Ways and Means Committee. So there are two bills. They are in separate committees, and that is the current status. You're absolutely right.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, on Senate Bill 978, actually, as I just mentioned, it is part of the governor's budget proposal and governor's package to be presented. It addresses both an amnesty window, as well as some enabling legislation to enhance the compliance tools the Department of Revenue has at its disposal.
Bob, let me just interrupt to say that there may be more relevance to this for our committee because the bill does have a subsequent referral for Ways and Means. Excuse me for interrupting.
Thank you. That's fine. When this package was put together, we had looked at a variety of states that have had amnesty packages in the past. And just, I'd like to begin, Mr. Chairman, just by some summarizing comments and then maybe talk a little bit about the magnitude of the problem. I'm also sensitive to the fact we've got a session coming up, so we'll do part of it today and we'll see how far we get. But states that have had a successful amnesty program have also had a corresponding increase in their enforcement tools so that they've sent a message to people that if they don't participate in the tax program that there will be someone that comes after them and they will more than likely get caught. They stand a higher chance of getting caught than they have historically, and that has been part of the success of an amnesty program in other states. That coupled with some advertising and a variety of media campaigns to let people know that it exists. Senate Bill 978 takes care of two of those components. It actually begins with an amnesty window, sets the time frames for that, and then creates a variety of administrative and penalty clauses for the target group that we're going to try to pursue, those that are non-filers or somebody's cheating on the program. What I'd like to do today, Mr. Chairman, is begin with having Jim Brown talk a little bit about the size of the problem, because I think it makes some sense for us to acknowledge how big the problem is before we start addressing the legislation to fix it. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Brown.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, for the chair.
As Jim goes through this, perhaps you folks can identify what you've done and are doing at the present time to resolve the problem, too. If you could build that in there, I'd appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Brown, Administrator of the Audit Division for the Oregon Department of Revenue. We did provide some graphic material that I believe was put in your books.
That came in the bill.
And maybe I can go through and explain the problem that the governor was trying to address with the tax equity program, and also get to some of Representative Trahearne's concerns about how we're currently dealing with these problems. The overwhelming majority of Oregon taxpayers are honest, and that really is demonstrated by the chart that's on page one of the material that we provided you. It shows the various sources of revenue that the State of Oregon General Fund currently has that the Department of Revenue administers. As you can see by that chart, of the total $1,458 million that should have been paid in taxes under the law in 1984, all but $146 million of that were voluntarily paid. That small piece of pie that's located somewhere, if you view this as a clock between 11 and 12 o'clock,
Mr. Chair,
is about 10% that does not get paid currently.
Mr. Chair. How do you arrive at the $1,458 million? Where does that number come from?
Where is the number in relation to the?
Well, no, I can see it on the chart. You're saying that's how much should have been paid.
That's correct.
And that $146 million were not. How do you know that that's how much should have been paid? Let me start it with that one, and you've identified then obviously how much wasn't, because you know how much you collected.
All of the pieces of the pie, with the exception of the $146 million, Representative Trahearne, are actual dollars from the statistics that come in. The $146 million tax gap is an estimate that we arrived at using some federal data on tax gap information that's done nationally. There's been literally dozens and dozens of national surveys on federal tax gaps. And we use probably a more conservative, those run all the way from a tax gap of somewhere around $100 billion a year to over $240 billion a year. We use the more conservative estimates of a federal gap of around $100 billion. We use the Oregon State University Research Center, and Dr. Robert Mason helped us take that federal data and using the demographic information for Oregon to apply that down to Oregon taxpayers. And we also have a lot of actual audit experience that we apply to that data to say, does it? The data says we're losing a certain amount of money, $11 million from non-filers, and now does our audit experience and our experience in going out and finding people that have not filed returns match that data? It's a combination of those two that we arrive at the 146. But you're correct, that is the one estimate on that chart. The chart on the next page is our estimate of the various sources with the help of Dr. Mason that shows what makes up that $146 million. And again, the largest piece of that pie, about $90 million of it, is the lower portion, are from people that file tax returns, but for whatever reason, don't report all of their income that should be subject to tax, and subsequently underpay their tax liability. That's, according to the national estimates and to our estimates, the single largest problem. Just above that, between what would be 12 o'clock and 1 o'clock, is another significant problem, and that is individuals that should be required to file income tax returns that simply do not file. And we estimate we're losing about $11 million a year from that. I might also point out that these numbers are annual figures, and that these numbers do not reflect any penalty and interest that might need to be paid should these be detected at a later moment. I guess going counterclockwise, the next 9% is 13.1 million that comes in, does not come in, excuse me, because of corporate noncompliance. And that tends to be mainly from large corporations that do business in many states. And in arriving at, there's generally not significant problems in arriving at their taxable income for the corporation in total. But then when you just go through the process of determining how much of that total taxable income should be subject to Oregon tax liability under the apportionment formulas in the statute, that's where there is a substantial amount of I guess you would call it, gray areas in the law that the corporations generally resolve in their favor, and we do a lot of audit work in that area. We find that a lot of those corporations should be reporting a larger share of their income to Oregon. That's the main thing that makes up that portion of money. The next $7.4 million is actually not an estimate, but an actual, and that comes from individuals and corporations that file returns and compute how much they owe us, but then don't pay it with a return. And that was $7.4 million in 1984. The $11.6 million from employer withholding is also an actual figure. That's employers that withhold taxes from their employees, hold the trust funds, and then maybe because they're struggling with their business, when the time comes to pay the money over to the state, they've diverted it to other uses and don't have the money to pay the state. So that 11.6 is an actual figure from there.
Representative Trader?
Looking at these last two, the 7.4 and the employer withholding, which, as you pointed out, are actual figures because those are numbers that are reported, yes, returns that are filed, if you will. Do you eventually get most of that, even though you may not get it on time?
Yes, Representative Trader. We do have a chart, maybe in a couple pages, that will show of those amounts, how much we currently get and what we currently charge off and what's currently being added to the receivable. But we do get the majority of that. The last 9% or $13 million comes from people that claim credits that they technically weren't entitled to, claim more deductions than they were entitled to, or make simple computational math errors on their returns. The next page is an indication of that $146 million that's not voluntarily paid, how much we currently recover annually from our efforts, and you can see it's about one-fourth of that. The remaining $110.5 million is monies that the governor was trying to address in the proposal of this program, money that currently is due under the tax laws of the state but is not being paid.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Eagle.
When we see that these taxes are due and not paid by the state, are the taxpayers aware that these taxes are due and are knowingly not paying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hugo, I'd say there's a combination. We have had a survey done by the Oregon State University Research Center in 1980, and the intention of the survey was to find out people's attitudes toward taxes and to find out specific questions about whether people knowingly underreported liabilities and knowingly failed to file. And the majority of this money, I would guess a high percentage of it, would be people that actually know that they owe it, know that they should have filed a return and don't, or know that they had some income that should be subject to tax but wasn't. But there is going to be a portion of this amount of money that people are, because of a technicality in the tax law that they weren't aware of, they claim capital gains when they shouldn't have or something.
Representative McCarty.
Okay, if this amnesty does come in and they file a return for that year, that will close the year. But if they previously filed a return and then file an amended return, in this case, would that give it open the year for another 3 years, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative McCarty.
How many years do we have to not have done that? That would open that amount for 3 years, or would that open the entire return for 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McCarty, in the two instances you talk about, if we had a person that hadn't filed a return under current statute, there is no statute of limitations. Once they file, yeah, the normal 3-year statute of limitations begin. So if a person hadn't filed a return and files under amnesty, then we would have a 3-year period from that date to audit the return.
Go ahead.
A person that had filed a return that's under the 3-year window that's open to audit now, if they amend their return and report additional income under amnesty, that 3-year window wouldn't change. If we had a 1-year period left in that 3-year window to audit at the time they filed, that's all we would continue to have. So it wouldn't affect the statute of limitations by amending under amnesty.
Okay. In other words, if it was just a small part of the return that was being amended, the rest of the year or the rest of the return would follow its statute of limitations. If it were after 3 years, then only that portion of the return that was amended would have the window of 3 year limitation,
sure.
Not the other part of the return.
I'm not sure, Representative McCarty, I'm understanding the question. If you had a return that was normally outlawed by statute.
Yeah, over 3 years.
Okay. And a person chose to amend that return under amnesty.
Yes.
Then the return would, we could accept the money under amnesty as a voluntary adjustment to that return, but we would not have any ability to audit that return because the statute's closed and amnesty in this legislation would not change that. We couldn't audit.
But the amnesty would still be open for 3 years.
Mm-mm. No, the item, maybe if I can use a specific example, let's say
How would that open the return is the question.
The simple answer to that, I guess, is that it would not open the return in any way.
Period.
Period. We couldn't adjust with regard to that item or any other. Maybe if I can quickly go through.
That's not true under the general amendments. When you amend a return, that portion of the return is still open up for the normal 3 years under an ordinary amendment.
On an ordinary, I'm not sure I'm tracking with you.
If you go back and amend a return that's over 3 years old, from that point, that portion, what you've amended, is still open for the following 3 years.
If you, under the current statute, as I understand it, Representative McCarty, if you amend a return and you claim a refund, then we have the ability to adjust that refund. But if, for example, you have a return that's outlawed and you amend voluntarily and say, I didn't report this income from a business. I had a business on the side. I didn't report the income. Here's an amended return, even though the statute's outlawed. Reporting that business income, we have no ability to audit that because the three-year statute with regard to that return is closed. And we cannot audit that business issue.
After 3 years, you can't apply for a refund.
No, that's correct. I'm talking about the example I'm giving now is a person that had a business, had income from the business, didn't report it on their returns. Normal statute expired. We didn't catch it. And now they voluntarily file an amended return and report the income. We have no ability to audit that. That year is closed.
Okay. Mr. Ebrams?
The next chart on page 4 is an indication, I think maybe we'll address Representative Trahern's question somewhat. It breaks down specifically the failure to file problem and how much is lost and how much that we currently gain by our efforts. We do have an automated program currently that matches some information with our master file. For example, we have the City of Portland business licenses with Social Security numbers that we will be matching against our master file to see if those people have filed returns. We do other various checks to see if people have filed, and that currently results in about $1.5 million a year in tax collections. The other portion of that pie is currently what's not being paid. It might be interesting, the next page, on page 5, we did a manual study of Medford City business licenses, and that chart shows you a breakdown of the type of licenses, the number of people that were licensed in each of those categories, and the persons requested to file is a column that shows the numbers of those people that hadn't filed returns. So using the first third item there, there were 454 people with construction licenses in the city of Medford, 42 of which, or 9.3%, had not filed returns. When we worked those, we ended up getting 63 returns because some were multiple year, and collecting $16,381 in tax penalties.
Jim, now these are the businesses, or are these the individuals that are in that type of business?
No, these are the businesses.
Okay.
In many cases, they may be individual proprietorships that report on their individual Schedule Cs. But this is the kind of data that we use to support the numbers we arrive at from the studies.
Okay. Okay, why don't you go ahead and cover the other pages, and then I think we'll quit for today. Session starts at 10:15. We will try to start working with this, you know, first thing tomorrow.
The next page is marked page 6, and that is essentially shows those people that don't pay their established liabilities, people that they've received a bill from us or they filed a return and say they owe some money. They know they owe it, and then we're in the process of trying to collect it. That's about $54 million a year, of which we currently collect about $38.7 million. About $5 million a year is charged off, and about $10 million a year is added on to the growing accounts receivable in the state. The next chart, marked page 7, deals with the major problem of underreporting of income and what we're currently doing with that. And that's the major emphasis of our field office staff, of our field auditors, is to do audits of self-employed people. That tends to be the area where most of this underreported income comes from. The next page is some federal data that shows, the important column is the right-hand column, and it shows various types of income, and from their studies, how much of that income is reported. It's interesting, like some business income, from their analysis, less than half of that ends up being reported on tax returns. And the last page in the handout shows the corporation tax gap that we estimate and what we do with that. As you can see, we make a pretty significant dent in that right now.